left my happy home to see what I could find out. My folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Well, I hit the rowdy road, many kinds I met there, many stories showed me how the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out. So much left to know when I'm on the road to find out.
Ooh. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth tellers and advocates from around the world. Unspun is a call-in show. If you have questions or comments for our guests or ourselves here at the studio, please call 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Co-hosting with me today is my good friend, Pamela Spoto, educator, poet, good friend, and I want to thank you, Pamela, for co-hosting with me today.
Well, good morning, and it's my pleasure.
It's good to have you because you always bring such interesting questions to the show. And we have an interesting guest to go along with the interesting questions on the phone, Professor Michael J. Coyle. He is currently Associate Professor in Political Science in the Political Science Department of California State University at Chico. Among others, he teaches courses on prisons, the so-called criminal justice system, difference, diversity, and deviance, and restorative justice. Michael has published his research in numerous books and academic journals with research and policy organizations and writes for national and local media focusing on the social cost of America's imprisonment binge. His most recently published book is Talking Criminal Justice, Language and the Just Society, and explores everyday language of what we call criminal justice. I want to welcome Michael to Unspun. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling this morning. Let me make sure.
Morning, Pamela. Great to be here.
Yeah.
Good morning, Dr. Michael Coyle, and we're excited about having you here, too.
And I didn't know if you had something you wanted to add to my introduction. I lost my script this morning, so I had to kind of fake it in.
See, here I printed
out. I'm impressed by what you did by memory.
well, it wasn't totally by memory, but thanks.
I had printed out numerous pages, and then Doug tried to take my pages because he lost his first page. But we're okay. We're good.
Yeah. I thought maybe you wanted to add something more about Professor Coyle's work, and might want to add something.
Oh, you're asking me. I thought you were asking Professor Coyle if he wanted to add something. Of course,
no.
I do. And on his bio, and I think this is really, really interesting, that he is a committed prison and justice activist. And I do think we are in a time of needed justice activism. And it also says here in his bio that he's worked, as a consultant, and he gives lectures on prison reform and abolition organizations, and that while he was doing his peaceful, nonviolent activist work, he has been a target of the FBI. But these investigations have never gone anywhere. So it's very curious to me. We live in a democracy. We're supposed to be an informed citizenry. And here Dr. Coyle has been doing all of this work, and people get concerned. Government gets concerned. I want to say one more thing. I'm sorry. I had the great fortune of taking his restorative justice class this last summer, and it was the most challenging and yet superb class that I have taken. It was so informative, and I learned a lot. So I'm very, very, as I said, excited about having Dr. Coyle on the air with us this morning.
Wow, that's quite a recommendation from Pamela. So, do you mind if I call you Michael? We're kind of
Please,
informal.
It's my preference.
Okay.
My preference.
Yeah. I think some of the work you're doing, besides your advocacy work and work in right you know, down on the street, so to speak, for justice and social and criminal justice both. But I thought maybe just quickly, because we don't want to go on about one thing too long. An hour goes by really quick. But in your book, Talking Criminal Justice, Language and Society, you mentioned Edward Saper, by the way, which I'm probably one of the few lay people in the world who know who Edward Saper is, because I did a college paper on language, and he was one of my heroes. And but you, I won't read the whole quote, but he says, let me see if I can pick out, "The fact of the matter is that the real world is to a large extent unconsciously built up on the language habits of the group. We see and hear and otherwise experience very largely as we do because the language habits of our community predispose certain choices of interpretation." And I thought that might be a good lead into some of your work and in the importance of what that means. Maybe you can explain that concept a little better for our listeners and what that right. means.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's an absolutely fantastic, very simple idea, which essentially says the following. You know, in our everyday life, how we think about language is that it's a tool. We have what we experience as a thought, and we immediately search for the words to describe exactly what it is we're saying, or we have a feeling, and we just look for the words to describe it. So we have this sense that language is really only this tool. There's all these words out there. We usually easily have command of several thousands of them, and we use it as a tool for communication. And while that is, of course, in part true, the larger part of language, the larger role that language plays, is actually it determines the very nature of our reality. Now, what does that mean? That doesn't mean that if you stand in front of a Mack truck, it's not going to run you over. No, it's going to run you over. Don't stand in front of a Mack truck, no matter how you describe it. But what we're talking about here when we say language is far more powerful is that the very words that we use to talk about things actually determine our very reality. I'll use a very relevant example to my work. You're walking down the street. You see two people coming down the street, and one of them reaches out, let's say, and slaps the other one. The moment that happens, here's what comes to your mind. Here's the language that you would use to describe it to yourself, to experience it, or to describe it to somebody else. Well, there was this person. He was the offender. He lifted up his arm, and he slapped the other person. The other person, say it was a woman, who received the slap, well, she's the victim. The moment the hand reached across and slapped the face, that was what we call the crime moment. When you have that experience, when you have that observation, when you describe it to somebody else, the very last thing that goes through your mind is that that entire description is actually a creation. You might even go so far as to say that it's fictional. But if you stop here for a second and think historically, there was actually a time when in the English language, the word victim, or the word criminal, or the word crime did not actually exist. In fact, you can actually trace this historically. So that then brings up the question of, well, what was it? Before that interaction was described so crystal clearly for everybody as an offender, a victim, a crime, what was that very interaction? How was that particular society, those societies, actually looking at that moment? Actually looking at those two people. And of course, that leads into some very, very interesting questions, not just about language, but also, and the role of language in our life and these things that we assume, but also how are we operating in our everyday lives? And interestingly, not just about the things that we call crimes, but about so many other things. How are we operating with these automatic assumptions of how things are, what things mean, when in fact all we're doing is recreating certain choices that were made a long, long time ago that we never particularly gave our okay to. We just sort of stepped into a conversation that was happening. And in many ways, my work around what we call the criminal justice system is all about pointing out these kinds of things. Let's stop, let's look at what is it that we are assuming about the very nature, to use an old word, of our human interactions, of these things that we call crimes that have given creation to this you know, enormous system, the criminal justice system, which is actually the third largest government program in the history of the planet. Only the United States Defense Department and the United States Social Security system actually spends more money. So it's absolutely gargantuan, and it's, you know, acknowledged pretty much by everybody in terms of, you know, areas of work. Not by, I'm not trying to suggest that everybody would say this, but it's widely, it would be a better word to use. It's widely acknowledged by both people in the country and people who work in it as a colossal failure. Lots of good intention, perhaps, but a colossal failure.
And at this point, Michael, I wanted to say something and then I'll also ask you several questions, because at the end of your bio that I have in front of me here, you say, our best hope for a just society is, or are, people who can think for themselves. And this involves, you know, the analysis, the critical thinking, the deep thinking, taking time to consider. You know, it's often in our culture today, we want things in a very fast-paced, speedy way on the, you know, on virtual reality, rather than really taking the time to understand and to think deeply. And it's interesting what you, the example that you gave, because excuse me, I was hoping that that could lead us into maybe your definition and description of restorative justice, because we have the terms of offender, victim, crime. Maybe the so-called offender, and I could be way off base on this, is that he slapped a deadly bug off of her face, you know, and he wasn't really an offender at all. I don't know. but we do use language to exclude and to demonize and to criminalize, especially like, for example, the poor and the homeless, that they've been crushed by our economic system, but now they have become criminals in the eyes of law enforcement. So in terms of restorative justice, which is really, really fascinating, and one aspect of it is transformation and, you know, incorporating these principles in our lives on a daily basis, because we're talking about the prison industrial complex. So how does restorative justice and the way we see the world change things? I guess that would be my question.
Yeah. Let's start with perhaps a little bit of an explanation of what restorative justice is for your audience, who may or may not include people who are not familiar with it. Restorative justice is older than anything that we have in terms of our modern system, what we call the modern criminal justice system. And it's a term that encapsulates a lot of ways of thinking and a lot of different ways of practice that has to do with how do you deal with the reality of the fact that human life is actually filled with human disagreement, human conflict, a lot of what we call crimes, from the very small to the very large. And that perhaps is, right now is perhaps the right moment to mention, too, that one of the problems with how we think about what we call crime in our society today is that we undercount it severely. Human lives everywhere are profoundly filled with conflict. And again, I repeat, I'm not just talking about the horribly, you know, violent sort, but also what we call the nonviolent crime. But moving on with the definition, restorative justice then is an alternative way of thinking about, because as we just explained, given the language example that Doug asked about, how we think about things is profoundly important. Restorative justice is an alternative way to think about how people respond to what kind of actions they take around crime. So let's take an example. Maybe we should take the example that we started out with these two people walking down the street. Let's say that it was actually a disagreement between the two about something, and it was actually an intentional violent hit, not about a bug.
Okay.
So in our modern criminal justice system, the response to that would be, draw the fact to the attention of this happening to the attention of law enforcement. There would be an arrest. There would be some kind of proceeding, ideally some kind of proceeding through some kind of court, and then there would be some kind of decision about guilt or innocence, and then there would be a decision about punishment. Restorative justice would respond to this incident different type of thinking and with actually very different goals in mind. The goals in mind for restorative justice are not retribution, are not punishment, are not organized around the trying to emphasize that some rule that has been broken. Rather, restorative justice stops, looks at the situation, and asks questions like, what is happening in these people's lives such that they're having these kinds of, in these two people's lives, such that they're having this kind of interaction? I mean, we all know that nobody likes to get hit, and we all know that we all basically understand that we shouldn't be hitting each other. So what's going on here? And if we're going to, if as a society we're going to have a reaction to these people being, to this incident, we would want it to be one where we're going to try to get everybody back on track, try to get the person who did the hitting back on track to shouldn't be hitting, and get the person who got hit back on track in life, deal with their trauma, their whatever, such that they shouldn't be in that position themselves. And for the audience, you know, you should be thinking about the story in terms of how it applies to everything. This would apply to somebody having something stolen. You would have, again, the person who's dealing is stealing and the person who's having something stolen. You should be thinking about any and all kinds of harms that restorative justice likes to talk about them instead of crimes. And we should be thinking also about how there's a profound impact on society. You know, when I was living in another city, when I was in school, I remember I lived in this apartment complex where there were 30 apartments, and in one of them, a murder happened. You know, something that happens not infrequently, actually, in the United States, unfortunately. And, you know, what happened after that incident was, the police came, they made an investigation, they made an arrest, and they went off, you know, and the entire process went off into the world of the criminal justice system. Everybody else in the apartment complex, it was as if there was nothing else to do. Everybody was profoundly impacted in the apartment complex. One of my neighbors was a woman who was living on her own. She began to think, well, what's going on with my safety? Am I no longer safe in this neighborhood? The people who were working in the staff in the apartment complex, they started getting so much pressure and so much stress and so much anxiety from all the people who were living there, of course, that their job became very difficult. And within 6 months, they had all actually left the employment, left the place of work, the apartment complex. So I'm mentioning all these things to bring up the fact that when there's a harm that happens in society, it profoundly impacts a lot of people beyond the law that got broken, beyond the rule that got broken, beyond the offender, the so-called offender, beyond the victim. So restorative justice essentially is an approach that says when something goes wrong in human relationships, when a harm, what we call a crime, is committed, we need to get into the lives of people, find out what's going on, and restore things, if you will. Of course, we need to restore the victim. We need to, you know, the victim's been hurt, and the victim needs compensation, the victim needs recovery, we need to address the victim. We also need to get into the life of the so-called offender. Surely, we're not going to solve anything. In fact, we know from research that we only make the problems worse by throwing somebody into a prison cell, by getting preoccupied with some idea of punishment. We know that the idea of punishment rarely works the way we think so. In fact, research has shown us that when you list up all the goals of punishment, it works less than 25% of the time. So the whole experiment is really a failure, widely speaking.
Michael, let me interrupt you just to remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Co-hosting with me today is Pamela Spoto, educator and host of Late Night Poetry Jam here on KKRN. And on the phone with us is Professor Michael Coyle, researcher and advocate for prison reform and restorative justice. We invite your questions and comments. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Well, coming back, you're your scenario there of two people coming up to each other on the street, and of course there was a victim assuming there was a victim in that scenario. What happens if we change that scenario and two people come together on the street? One person hands the other person a bag of dried flowers, and that person in turn hands this person some currency, and they both walk away, and nobody's harmed, and yet this is basically the description of the war on drugs, which is, as you said before, our system has failed, and that's one of the greatest failures. So what I'm curious of what your take would be if we take that scenario and, kind of take that apart and see how that leads to injustice, what I see as injustice.
Could I say one thing? I'm interjecting right before Michael. That's a terrible thing. I do want to say for our listeners too, and I'm sure that Michael would address this as well, is that we have more people incarcerated than any other country in the world, over 2.3 million people, and most of those people are people of color and people who don't have literacy skills, that aren't highly educated. And in other countries, drug offenses, people are not sent to prison. We have this huge profit-making system.
I was going to let Michael point
out. I'm just introducing this for okay, I'm going to be quiet now. Go ahead. We're having a conversation.
That's right. It's a conversation.
That's right. You know, these are the goodies, indeed. These are the goodies. It's so just, I don't know what word to use other than unbelievable in terms of the war on drugs, and I know more and more Americans are getting behind this and starting to realize how innately problematic it is. You know, I mean, here's really all you need to know. Everybody knows about the country of Portugal in Europe right next to Spain. This country has made all drugs legal. What has happened in Portugal since they did that? Drug use has actually gone down, not up. It's actually gone down. You know, the history, especially in the United States, of trying to legislate, you know, moral choices is absolutely littered with one failure after another. I mean, a lot of people will remember what happened with alcohol in the beginning of the 20th century and how it was made illegal and what happened. It was very straightforward. It's very persistent. The same thing happens every time a new drug enters the market and it's made illegal. There's a very large, violent outbreak because if you can't settle the market under legal means, it gets settled with violence. So what do we have attached with the drug market? We have a tremendous amount of violence. What's our explanation for that violence? As if we don't have the example of prohibition before us? That somehow it's attached to the drug trade. Very, very potentially not, given what's happened historically. And it's heavily time for us to begin to participate, and in some very small ways, with the legalization of marijuana, but it's very small. But it's, I would argue that it's time for us to start investigating much more heavily. I understand the hesitation of not... I understand the temptation or the desire of a community to say, this is the way we want to live, these are the rules we want to have, these are the things we want to do, these are the things that are going to be okay, these are the things that are not going to be okay. That's terribly appropriate. There's never been a society that doesn't do that. In fact, that's what it means to be a society. It means to say that when we all get together and we live together, these are the rules by which we're going to live. And that drive, that very appropriate drive, has to be tempered by something. It can't be wild and crazy. You can't tell people they can't leave their houses, for example. We all understand that. Well, where does that stop? Where do we negotiate that line where we make rules about how we want to live together and we also leave people alone? That's really the problem with this drug war legislation. We seem to face enough evidence that trying to legislate people of their drug use is actually profoundly damaging, not only to the people who are using drugs, it actually ends up making them even, because of the way the criminal justice system works, more dependent, not less in the end for most of them. It creates a tremendous social expense, the cost of the criminal justice system. It's inherently violent, because of what it does to people, meaning the entire process of incarceration, etc. And obviously, as all the research shows us, it doesn't work. So time to move on.
Well, that brings up another question that I have, and I was kind of jotting down some things as you were talking, and it seems like in some ways the war on drugs and the military-industrial complex both make billions of dollars. And I'm wondering if any change, I mean, it seems to me that we, many people know what you said, and yet there's this attitude, let's not be soft on drugs. Oh my goodness, it's going to get into the community more if we're not harsh about this. But I'm wondering if changes are going to happen because there's so much money. People make so much money. I'm not talking about the drug lords necessarily. I'm talking about the prison industrial complex, the DEA, the Border Patrol. It just goes, you know, on and on. So how do we, is there a possibility we're going to be able to, you know, transcend that? I mean, the same thing goes in my mind in terms of the military-industrial complex. How do we change that if there's so much money involved?
And let me interject.
Okay.
Well, not only that, but as you mentioned, the military-industrial complex, which is the Pentagon, is the main agent for that, and the prison and industrial complex.
Yes.
So these are huge things that America has invested in. And it seems like once these things are empowered, it's almost impossible to unwind them.
They are absolutely huge, dangerous. And, you know, we've had very important people historically identify the coming of, like, presidents of the United States. You know, the coming of the industrial complex, the arrival of the industrial complex, the dominance of the prison industrial complex. You know, we could tie so many things into this. You know, the current, you know, global economic crisis, what happened, you know, in Greece over the summer for readers who were watching, you know, international news and economics. We have more and more in our world, we've become much smaller, and we are very powerfully determined by what a relatively small number of very large corporations, conglomerates, who are pursuing very legally, according to the law that we've designed, the pursuit of profit. And we have allowed this essentially to become the holy grail. And to preserve the right for a few people, very, very few people, to become unimaginably wealthy, we sacrifice the wealth and the health of the majority. And this is as true as it is for national economies. For example, five banks in Germany made more profit out of all the money that they have lent Greece in the last 5 years, which is a tremendous amount. It's over $300 billion U.S. dollars. But they actually made more money than they have lost making these loans. In other words, it's all about profit. The military-industrial complex, you know, major countries like the United States, Israel, France, Japan, Germany again, profit untoldly. These who are these countries really? But when we say countries nowadays, they are simply fronts representing, in a serious sense, these corporations, so that they can go ahead and make these profits. It's the same thing with the prison industrial complex. Every year I teach, I will stop with this story, back to you guys. Every year I teach a course on prisons. I wrap up the course the last couple of weeks by teaching about an idea, which I'd like to talk about that too if you guys are interested, the idea of penal abolition, which is this idea that, you know, we need to move beyond our criminal justice system, perhaps in a larger sense than trying to reform, but, you know, starting to give up these institutions. So anyway, in the class, in the last couple of weeks, I teach the idea of, we engage some readings and discuss the idea of prison abolition. And after the 2 weeks are done, I do a quick survey. I ask my students, take out a quick piece of paper and give me the three reasons why you think we should abolish the prisons and three reasons why you think we shouldn't. Well, every semester, the top reason of why the students, most of them, by the way, really love the idea of prison abolition at the end, but the top reason of why they think we should not abolish prison is the following. there's too many jobs and there's too much money in it, and that's going to be a problem. Like, you know, where am I going to go work? I'm finishing here with a criminal justice degree, and if I don't get to work in the prisons, where am I going to work? So it's incredibly individual. It's all about the money, and it's real, like everything else, like the military-industrial complex, like any international global crisis that's going on. It's about the money. Follow the money, as the economists always say.
Let me take a little break here and give our little station ID and other information to the listeners. You're listening to Unspun on KKRN 88.5 FM in Bella Vista. KKRN is a community radio station that is funded by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. If you wish to support our efforts and you like what you hear on the air, go to our website at kkrn.org and click on the donate button. Coming back to prison abolition, we had Prop 47, just as an example, last year, I think it was, that passed. And before that, we had something, I think it was AB 106 or 109, and so many of the conservative people in our community just were up in arms. They're releasing criminals, murderers, rapists onto the streets, and they're allowing these criminals to go free even after they've been found guilty. And I guess my question to you is, are these deep-rooted, I think it's, you know, fear-mongering that seems to work both for the prison complex and the military-industrial complex. When people are fearful, and I mean, they tend to kind of get more and more conservative to the point that they harm themselves. So what are your thoughts about those two, you know, I think, I don't know, you probably know the right bill number there. I think it was AB 109 or, but Prop 47, yeah. Both of them released people onto the streets for really not violent crimes.
I think the best way to answer your question is to history. I find history is always so instructive. The best way to answer your question is to share the following fact. Imagine living in the United States 200 years ago. 200 years ago in the United States, the three most commonly, most often prosecuted crimes were the following three. Not attending church, having sex out of wedlock, and not being gainfully employed. All right. Now, those things aren't illegal, much less even immoral. In fact, somebody would feel sorry for you if you weren't actually doing those things these days. But stop for a moment here. Stop for a moment here and imagine that you were living in this country 200 years ago, that this was your everyday reality, same as our everyday reality around these issues of so-called crime are what they are. These, you know, most often prosecuted crimes were your reality. And imagine being around a conversation of a few people talking about how, yeah, I don't know, you know, things are kind of changing. Maybe we're going to want to rethink about, you know, these being the most prosecuted crimes, you know. And imagine the uproar that that would bring from your society. You know, this little historical nugget is indicative of the reality that we live in. Change is difficult. We all have, not strangers, but we all experiences. Change is inherently difficult, and yet things change. You know, I feel very much the same. I feel very, very strongly that the way, you know, the so-called criminal justice system that we have is not going to exist for very much longer. I don't know how much longer it is, but I think it's very safe to assume that it's not going to. Actually, let's take the institution of a prison. I mean, prisons didn't exist until 200 years ago. They're a very recent invention. The idea of holding somebody, but holding them very temporarily, be it in a dungeon or be it in a castle or some other temporary holding facility, absolutely has existed throughout time. But never as a permanent social institution, never at any size of importance whatsoever, much less something like we have today with prisons with several thousand people. And the institution itself has always been a drastic failure. Again, history is so indicative. The first report that was ever written about the first prison, which was here in the United States, actually in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Street Jail, the first report that was written essentially came came out and said, okay, essentially this institution is not working. It breeds violence because it locks up people in tight spaces. People who come out actually are in worse shape than when they went back in again. The people who are coming here really need a different kind of attention other than being locked up in a small space. Basically, this prison idea is a terrible disaster. We need to shut it down and forget this little experiment. Here we are 200 years later, where not only is it the United States is it the dominant social institution of how to train people of what to do and what not to do, but also it's the global idea now. I mean, we've actually spread it literally across the planet. So to come back to your question, Doug, you know, about proposition this and proposition that, you know, these are... The reaction to them is very understandable. I'm very empathetic towards Americans who don't have the leisure and the fortune that somebody like me has had, the choices that I've made of, you know, going into student loan debt to sit around and read books and think about these kinds of things and then have ideas about them. I mean, you know, most of us are actually running around otherwise very busy in our lives, you know, going from work to home to make dinner if we have children or dependents take care of them, because at the end of the day, we're exhausted. We're very naturally caught up in the everyday life, and there's very little time for deep thoughts, and there's very little energy for serious consideration. For this, we depend on people who have time. Maybe some of it is academics, like myself, you know, to propose idea. Maybe some of it is on our political leadership to actually propose, you know, new directions and new ideas. The best thing that we can do, I think, as a public, is try to keep as open a mind as possible. You know, think about history and really think for ourselves. You know, as Pamela was saying at the beginning of the show, this is really the only hope that we have ever had and that we still have, is preserve these ideas, these wonderful ideas that we have about democracy and freedom of people to participate in their own lives and in their community lives, and for them to make these decisions for themselves and to participate in the community decisions. And how we can do the best of us comes out when we retain these freedoms for ourselves. We don't let oppressive governments, we don't let oppressive institutions tell us what to do, but we keep thinking for ourselves and we try to keep an open mind and realize that things really change, and that's difficult maybe, but that's okay.
And I wanted to say three things and bring up several more questions, because, and this relates to what you said just now and a few moments ago, and I guess I'll just say it. I see Wall Street as Wall Street, the banksters, the oligarchs, the putting pressure on large groups of, pardon me,
the
plutocracy as well. And so we're coming up against we the people, 99%, we the people are coming up against the others, the 1% with tons and tons of money, and we have the corporate media. And the reason I mention that is because how do we make, excuse me, people more informed, as you had just mentioned, in terms of being, you know, deeper thinkers? I mean, people have lives, they have school, they have jobs, they have children, they're trying to figure out how they're going to pay the bills. And so how do we encourage more education, more thinking, becoming a more informed citizenry, so we can be a democracy rather than an oligarchy or a plutocracy? And then, for example, when people think about prisons, oh yeah, not in my backyard, but I want those people in prison, that the notion of a lot of people in prison need education, they need rehabilitation, you know, the people of color, the economic distress that many people are in, going back to the person on the street or the couple on the street, rather than, you know, as you had mentioned, what are the man's circumstances, what are the woman's circumstances, why is it we arrest more young black men than we do young white men for drug alleged drug crimes, are blacks just easier to find? mind, you know? So there are those two things. And then I think about restorative justice and the class that you taught this last summer, and some of the points that were so, so moving to me, and I have them written down right here in front of me. And for example, you know, as you had mentioned, repairing the harm, restitution, the humanization of the other. It's moving beyond those stereotypes that as let's say a white officer from a white background might see the black young black male as someone to be feared and dangerous, rather than this is just a kid like anybody else. So the humanization of the other, respect, you know, forgiveness, transformation. And it seems as though the researchers are also saying, you know, we need to learn these things and we need to incorporate if we really want transformation to happen. And you had mentioned that you see the prison system changing and, you know, maybe the whole penal institution being abolished. You know, how do we get there when we're up? That's the question. How do we get there when we're up against tons of money and a corporate-owned media and education that is being more based on a corporate model?
Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing is don't lose hope.
Oh.
Things can change absolutely overnight. You know, I will never forget in 1990, one night I went to bed, and when I went to bed, the world's biggest problem was the Cold War. And then I woke up the next day, and the Berlin Wall was done, and the Cold War was over. You know, I mean, things change in an instant when you least expect them. So how we get to something new is, first of all, we don't lose hope. We keep doing the work that we're doing. Each of us individually, the work that you're doing with the radio show, the work that I do in my activism or in my teaching, the conversations that people have, you know, with their families, with the people that they live with, and, you know, keep advocating for the ideas. I mean, what happened in the United States? This is why there's good reason to be hopeful, and it's, you know, this is why I stay optimistic. What happened in the United States in the last year, such that all of a sudden, despite the fact that a certain reality has been going on for centuries, for decades, if not even close, more than that, actually, definitely more than that, of policing, right? Where all of a sudden, the entire country has woken up to, my God, what is going on with black men and policing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is going on? And all of a sudden, it's everywhere, and it's what everybody's talking about. And you open up the news, and it's one of the top stories, and what people are talking about. All of this to say, I think that certainly those of us who get the leisure and the luxury to sit back and think about these things and look at where we are, we see tremendous gaps and we see tremendous holes, and oh my God, we have so far to go. There is the thing to do is to keep hope alive, to keep talking, to keep working. And things eventually do change. Are there things that we can do? Are there things that we can encourage people to do? Absolutely, of course. You know, get involved. That's the first thing that you can do. If you can, it doesn't matter if you can't do it 5 hours a week. If you can spend 15 minutes a week, that's fantastic. Pick an issue that really gets your goat, that you think the society is really going in reverse about. Sit down, write a letter to a paper, go to a web page, respond to a post that's being, you know, offensive in the opposite direction. Get involved. And this, by the way, is one of the major lessons of restorative justice, is that you cannot be someone who does not participate in your own problems in life. This is one of the unfortunate things that the criminal justice system has taught us. It has taught us to not participate in our own problems. As soon as a so-called crime happens, what happens? The institution steps in, the law steps in, the police step in, the prosecution steps in, the court steps in, the prison steps in. The person who suffered the harm, the community that suffered the harm, has no say in it. We need to be actively participating. And this starts from the tiny little thing of, your neighbor's stereo is too loud, you don't call the police. You actually go over, you knock on the door of your neighbor, and you try to work it out. When something larger than that happens, the same thing. Get involved. Start talking to your institutions about becoming involved. There are community efforts in just about every community. And if there isn't one in your community, you can start one. There are always resources near you. There are many organizations that are interested in
seeing more use of ideas like restorative justice. Get involved with them. Call them up, see if they need half an hour of volunteering this month. It just takes a little bit from everybody.
Let me remind our listeners one more time. You're listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Co-hosting with me is Pamela Spoda, educator and host of Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN. And on the phone is Professor Michael Coyle, researcher and advocate for prison reform and restorative justice. We invite your questions and comments. This will be your last chance to call in, so call in if you have a comment or a question. The number here is 530-337-1885. 530-337-1885. Well, I just want to, things that you're saying just bringing up so many thoughts in my mind, but I'm kind of a student of history also, and when I look at our country, it is basically a country of oligarchs. Even our founding fathers were oligarchs. Most people don't know that. George Washington was one of the richest men in the world at the time, and we won't go into all of that. But my point is, we have this basically white European oligarchy is our – that's our source. That's where we came from, and we're continuing that, mostly white male from European descent in America. So I guess – my question is this bias, which is obviously built in over hundreds of years, part of our culture, we have a racist class bias to our thinking. Our media is the same thing. I tend to be more cynical, where you're saying be hopeful. I'm going, you know, we got how do you, we can't afford to buy back the media. That's long gone, and so how do we get away from this? You were talking about more or less Michael Brown's murder by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, a little over a year ago, and I went and actually looked at a couple headlines real quick on Google last night, and the headlines from that, the first days of protests, I'll just read two of them. One of them is chaos: protesters defy curfew. Another one was out of control. Tear gas, flash grenades fly to subdue crowds. So we have this bias that so obviously filters through everything constantly, and our system is basically rigged, like you say. You say naturally caught up people in their lives, but it's really not that natural. This is another policy decision by the plutocrats to keep us poor and our head down and struggling against each other. So all of this class racist bias is built into the system from top to bottom, and it angers me. And I'm just, you know, I'm not quite, I guess I'm saying, I'm not quite as positive as you are that we can overcome it. It may be the collapse of our society.
I really understand that that sentiment, and I'm not pretending that I don't have those moments. I woke up this morning looking at the news, and first thing I read was about this 24-year-old man, black man, who was died in a Virginia jail, basically by malnutrition. He lost 65 pounds in 4 months. Basically, he died of hunger in his jail cell. Nobody noticed. Well, nobody noticed in the prison, perhaps. The ACLU, the family, they went to court. They argued for his health. The court issued orders, and nothing happened. And this man actually, essentially, by what it seems, by the report this morning, starved to death inside his jail cell. And this is, you know, by the way, mentally ill, diagnosed with schizophrenia. You know, these stories that are just so absolutely tragic surround us. I think, you know, Doug, we need to start with reality. Reality is, there is racism, but it's a bit more than that, unfortunately. There's really only one term that applies, in my view, my read of the situation, and that's white supremacy.
Yes.
I mean, it's that severe. Racism is really putting a nice label on it. You can't live in a society where people of color are accosted the way they are in our society and have been historically, and call this, you know, a problem of racism. It's white supremacy. It's radically intentional. It's unbelievably bad the way you speak about it. But let me get to your question, you know, how does, you know, how do you, he's saying, hey, Michael, you know, I'd like to hear the song.
Oh, we're losing you.
We're kind of losing you there, Michael.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. We can hear you now.
We missed that last sentence. So.
Yeah. All right. Let me repeat it. You know, I essentially understood your question to be, Michael, I appreciate your optimism, but when I look around, how I feel is pessimistic. And, you know, I understand it. I mean, there's a way to look around, and you can find lots of evidence for that. But if we're going to win the day, we're going to win the day by believing that it's possible. I think we started our hour today by talking about hope, you know, that we have to remain hopeful, that we have to keep working. And when I look, again, looking at history, when I look at the social movement or leaders within those social movements that have accomplished the absolutely seemingly impossible, that is where they started. They started with the confidence. They started with the hope of something that didn't really seem all that reasonable at the time, that it was achievable. Who could have predicted, you know, that we can actually live in a society today where law protects not only women, I mean, 100 years ago, women weren't voting, where law protects not only people who are not identifying as heterosexual, in the military now, even openly. Who would have guessed in the middle of slavery in the United States that someday we would actually abolish slavery and look back at that as one of the greatest shames of our lives? People would stand up, congressmen and women would stand up and argue, are you crazy, we're going to abolish slavery, ruin our economy, etc., etc. History teaches things change radically, and how they change is more often than not, if not always, by people who stand up, people who say, not on my watch, who are hopeful, who are determined, who are committed, and who say, this isn't right, and I'm just going to keep saying that, you know. And now here we have Black Lives Matter, this new movement that's emerged out of this last year, raising consciousness in the American imagination, the American awareness of how black men are treated in this society. They interrupted Bernie Sanders' political speech and essentially forced him, and what we've seen has happened since, for him to come to terms with how his entire political agenda and platform isn't really thinking about the reality of African Americans, have changed things. But in consequence, that's going to change every Democratic candidate that's going to come. Oh, I better have my thoughts clear about that from now on. Or they actually stepped in last week into the D.C. mayor's announcement of another untold amount of money being spent to more police and more police officers for the same old problems that everybody knows is going to end up hurting black men. They interrupted his speech. An African-American mayor, by the way. They interrupted his speech, and they stopped him, and they said, no, this is not acceptable, right? That would be my message, Dr. Pamela, is history shows us this is what makes a difference. It actually happens, and we have to do it. We have to remain hopeful no matter our death moments. We have to keep saying the things that we believe in. We have to keep fighting for them, and change is inevitable. Good luck stopping it. Nobody's ever been able to.
And you're right. And we only have about 5 minutes left, and I have so many questions, but I'm going to have to. Doug's shaking his head. No, no. And I believe you're totally right about focusing on the hope. For me, focusing on the gratitude. It's really hard to do that. You know, and I agree, you know, the changes that have taken place that we would have thought historically would never have been possible, abolishing slavery, then it takes the ugly form of, you know, Jim Crow, racism, white supremacy. And I think probably someone like Angela Davis would say, you know, in the prison industrial complex now, you have slavery. That is what you have with people of color working for no wages or 5 cents on the hour. But that being said, if I continue focusing on that all the time, it's very, very bleak. And so I think hope is essential to hold in my heart. And Doug is motioning. I think there are three minutes left. Is there any final, I mean, any final points that you would like to tell us, or what would you like to do? What would you like to say?
You know, if I have a few minutes left, and Doug's not dying to get in there to tell us how we should have a dark moment last morning.
No. Go ahead. It's your time.
I'm intrigued, Doug. I really appreciate those dark moments happening myself. But if we're going to, you know, if I'm going to spend the last few minutes, I guess, you know, what I would like to talk about is, you know, what I'm working on right now, which is the next book that I'm doing is called Seeing Crime, Penal Abolition and the End of Utopian Criminal Justice, where I'm making an argument from a very simple observation that actually is constantly exploding in my observation around the world. And that is that when we hear of new ideas, when we hear advocates, activists, politicians, community leaders talk about, you know, new realities that we can work towards, a very common response is to say, oh, that sounds so utopian, that sounds so idealistic. And what I've actually been observing, interestingly, is that we are at a moment in time right now, we are at a moment in history where a lot of that seems to me to be exactly the opposite. Let me quickly explain. I think the criminal, for example, the criminal justice system is probably the most utopian construction that exists. I mean, stop and think about this for a moment. Despite the fact that we have literally endless volumes of evidence that demonstrate the opposite, we actually operate in this society thinking that using police works, that law works, that prisons work, and that the entire criminal justice system is engaged in this process of stopping people from doing quote-unquote bad things, and somehow that works to stop people from doing bad things, stop these people who are doing these bad things from doing bad things. That has actually never happened. So the very conception of the criminal justice system that we have now is actually utopian. It's this imaginary construction that we are going to be able to stop and change society and change people by using the system, which suddenly makes the idea that we need to stop doing these things and start doing new things the reality and not the utopia.
Well, that's a good message to end with, and we're just about out of time. You're going to hear our musical cue come on here. Yeah, that's our cue to wind down. So I want to thank you, Professor Michael Coyle, for being on Unspun with us today.
Yes, thank you so much, Michael. It was wonderful.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you again. Bye-bye. And Pamela, thank you for co-hosting with me today.
Oh, I really wanted to do that because I thought this would be a particularly interesting show. All of your shows are interesting, but this is particularly interesting.
But when you're on, they're even more interesting.
Oh, well, thank you, Doug.
You've been listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth Telling on KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio. Our guest today has been Professor Michael Coyle. Dr. Coyle is currently Associate Professor in Political Science Department of California State University. Chico is an educator and advocate for reform in criminal justice system and restorative justice. He has numerous books that have been published. He has one really great one that's been published, and he has another one coming up. And I will put links to him and his books on our website with the archives of this show. Next week on Unspun, we'll be talking with Jeff Schauer, historian, outspoken local blogger on Reading Record Searchlight's website. His political observations are particularly interesting and accurate. Please tune in next Saturday, 9 a.m. to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth Telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye. Next up on KKRN, Peace Talks Radio.